Accession number 10008, reel number 2.
Mr. Clough, reel 2.
Maybe sit down with the other lads over there, about 8 or 9 of them or so. We sat there a bit and these Germans were walking all over the place. They went in the gun pits and then laid an explosive charge in the breech of each gun, or 4 guns. Didn't make much of a crack. And then this one of them come across, and just where we were sat, there's what we call the junction box, where the cables come from the command post into that, and then out to the guns, and he saw that, and he pulled it up, and he saw all these cables, and he couldn't speak English, you know, what was that, more or less. When a bloke says, pointed, and then, you know, get through to him that he made a gun move around. So he gets his knife out and he cuts them.
He did what?
Cut the cables on this junction box. You know, like to sabotage him. And we sat a bit more, and then another Jerry comes over, he says, power.
What was he doing with his fingers?
4 men he wanted, you know, I couldn't speak English, most of them. You know, like that, they were rough buggers.
Telling them to come?
Yeah. So I stood up and 3 of them, and he took us into number 1 gun pit, which were near where that glider had come down, had been riddled with machine gun. And I remember there was a Jerry in the LA, and looked, he had his brain blown out across the cable of the gun, the cradle. And there's some more wounded Germans in there. So we had to pick one of them up. He got an army blanket, which was in the gun pit, laid his Jerry in it, and we had to go out of each corner. Then he took it across the gun sight, walked behind him with a bloody Luger, took us right down to Olive Grove's, where the tent's at the far end, and actually there was a glider there, I noticed. And we put him in a tent, and then he let us go in the tent. They were all wounded, a lot of them. Then we stopped there, all day more or less. I was laid next to a young German. I think he had a broken leg, this one, I don't know, but he'd been wounded or something. And
were you getting any food or water?
Not nothing, no. Breakfast had just been made, but they told me that Germans had half in it. They didn't give us anything, nothing. Not a bloody bit. And then a lot of firing going on. You could hear planes coming down and Stuka screeching, you know, they were bloody siren on them. And we laid it all day, like, and one of the lads got through to one of Jerry's what we laid in there, and he could talk a bit of English. Good on, like, more or less normal terms by then. And we always stood at the doorway at tent with a bloody Tommy gun, and he kept letting rip, and so at one time there was a car or a road about 500 yards away, and I saw the shooting break shooting down. He just whipped up and tight it. Of course, he didn't like it, that way, with Tommy. Like that all day. And a hell of a noise going on. And then things got a bit rough. There were many bullets flying through top of tent and also, which, you know, when these Germans, German community says, you can talk a bit of English, you get through with it. Some of our blokes are coming down to attack, you know, to get them away. Things got pretty hot, and in the end, they come up. They took us out of the tent, and up that olive grove, they rove slit trenches for off-duty men to get in the raids. 2 of them jumped in, and made us lay down, full length at the back of it. Now, Charlie Milner says we used us as sandbag, but I don't believe that. Made to lay it back, you see. And the Marines were coming this way. And we laid there, and these 2 were in bloody trench. We were an Austrian. A vicious looking sod. And he whips his bloody para knife out. Them slick knives he had. And he wants you know, well, Charlie Milner, that who I believe he got to, he stood up. He was with me.
He was signalling with the knife.
He wanted something doing with knife, yeah. So Charlie stood up, Charlie Milner. And I remember it now, he comes to Dinnington and he says, what's up, old lad? Like, I couldn't know what I was talking about. But he got through Charlie what he wanted. There was a tent just by him. He wanted him to cut strips of cloth out and put them on the deck in the shape of a swastika. So as they're planning to know, they still occupy that bit. So Charlie did that. He's some guts, that lad. I mean, there was stuff flying all over. And he come back, lays down, and his thing got a bit taut, and he and Jerry were grunting at each other and kept letting rip. And all of a sudden, the boss said something to each other, and they jumped out of bloody trench. And it went through my mind, they go, they'll let us have it before they go, but they didn't. They just run back. Then we dived, got into trenches, same bloody quick. Ronnie there, Master of War, a few seconds, and we see these, looked up, these blokes are coming through trees, and it were the Royal Marines. So he stood up and shouted, "Don't shoot, we're English, like, you know, British." And that were it then.
So the Marines had driven them off?
They drove them, they followed them right through. Now, what happened then? I didn't see this myself, but what happened? He said, "Gosh, in that olive grove, the load of men that, you know, he's got them spare men, you know, cooks and all that lot. Now, during the day, just get it trenches, because a load of stuff coming down. But when Jerry landed, they come through them bloody olive groves, and this is perfectly true. He blocks unarmed, with 8 rifles on that side, that's all, 8. And they were in the command post. They just walked through that olive grove, and the men were absolutely unarmed, and they stood at each trench and let ripped every bloody trench.
Did you see it?
I didn't see that with my own eyes, but I know it's happened. I know one or two that survived. That's all bodies afterwards, anyway. One lad, Horace Cross, who was in Birmingham, he survived, and he were in one of them trenches. He was a driver.
What was his name?
Horace Crossley. And he were a driver. And they did, when they come to his trench, he like this, and he just let rip. And Horace, this is unbelievable as well. 2 bullets hit his bloody tin at rim, and he had his hand like that. And one bullet went through here, through the back of his hand. And he survived.
Why do you think the Germans massacred prisoners on this occasion?
They also massacred in the command post, I'll tell you that bit. You know, when they took us away by the gun pit from the trench. As they come out of the gun pit, Mr. Corbett, he'd been shot through the face. Charlie turned around and said to Charlie Milner, he was with him there, he said, do as you told, Milner, or you'd be killed. He knew what they were. And as they come out of the trench, out of the command post, they were shooting them as they come out. And Charlie got a bit in his hand. He was lucky. And if you read that, Corbett's hand, they shot Mr. Cacollis. They didn't shoot Corbett, got away with it then. But what happened, this Jerry who was shooting him was quite a command post, after he surrendered, mind you. He's shooting him and he wounded him, one of his own blokes. Put a bullet in one of his own bloody men, so the killing stopped then. But the reason was, I think, now looking back, I mean, I thought I said it was an atrocity, but they had to silence those guns. We were in a position, that drop I told you about at Galatos, by a mile or so away, if we'd have been in action, we could have blasted them planes and them parachutes out of the bloody sky. We had to be silenced. But they were just at that time, they weren't taking no prisoners. It's a terrible thing, but that happened.
When you said they were behaving in a rough way... When you said they were behaving in a rough way, what exactly did you mean?
Well, their actions. I mean, they got to pick the number one gun to take that wounded out. I mean, they weren't... Look for horse, and they were... Them sort of action, you know.
Jerking their gun, do you mean?
Yeah, but, you know... The impression I got was if put one foot out of place and that's a bloody lot, you know. There was no hesitation, even after the killing were over. Until they really calmed down later on in the day.
Did they seem excitable?
Not excitable as such. To me, they looked just callous bosses to me somewhere. I mean, they're a rotten job, I know. I mean, our blokes must have done the same in situations, you know. I mean, there's our time when you can't take prisoners, isn't there? But the way they went about on that site, they must have realised we were unarmed in a tent line with only guns in command post. They killed quite a lot of them, did our blows, if you read that right. They couldn't have helped it. The reason I think was they landed to silence that site and they were quite away from their own main body. They knew they couldn't keep prisoners. And if they'd left us, we could have been some use again as infantry or something. It was just cold-blooded murder, actually, but that were it. There's not enough being said about that, actually, but... Man, it's all over and done with now, you know. I've no bitterness myself.
When the gliders landed, could you hear the sound of the gliders landing?
Well, I didn't, because there's such a lot of noise, I was deafened anyway.
What did the gliders look like?
Oh, the big buggers. Steel shods on. The big wingspan, the big things. There's a land, I've been out in bottom of the Oligo, one wing were off, like, ripped its wing off as it come down and stuff like that. I believe they landed about eight or nine.
When the Marines came in, were any Germans captured?
They only left behind the wounded. Hot rest went.
How were the wounded treated?
Well, they ended up in a convent with me, what were left of them, what were wounded. They were treated all right, far as I know. There was a tale, but I don't know, this is hearsay, that one of the Marines, the wounded Jerry, near command post, I can't mean the command post, and this Marine, he'd seen all slaughter, and he turned his head a bit, and he sat in front of me with a Tommy gun, and he, you know, made him sweat a banner shoot him, he didn't. That was the story. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. You can see it could happen. It was terrible. The aftermath were awful.
So, once the Marines came, presumably you were then looked after, were you?
Yes. There's just one other thing I'd like to mention about where they carried on. A pal of mine, Alfie, lives in Cleckheaton. His legs riddled with his grenade stuff. He were off duty that day, him and Bamford, he were a Cleckheaton lad. Now their gun in that 24 hours were on relief. All right. Was on relief. The spare team of drivers were trained up. They were manning it. Well, he were off duty. And he told me there were a little oil in ground, a little dug like an air raid shelter. And him and Bamford, Ted Hooker, that were their gun sergeant, another lad, they run into this trench, this hole in the ground, like, you know, like a little shelter. They stopped there, and then when Jerry got to them, they just threw a couple of grenades in. These stick grenades, I think they were. And Alf and Ellis Bamforth, they were just round this corner, round a bit door, a bit steps into it. Now these grenades, both of them in the legs. Other lot in there didn't get hurt. There was an officer in there as well, Mr. Jones. Now just think, everything went quiet, and Bamford, Ellis, his leg must have been very, very bad and in agony. So he says to Harvey, he said, I can't stick no more, he says, I'm going out. They knew Jerry were outside. So he went up steps like this.
With his hands up?
He did hands up. They just cut him in half with a bloody Tommy gun. Well, Mr. Jones, Alf's told me this. He was in that trench with him, that hole. And Mr. Jones, the officer, he were off duty at the time. He couldn't get to command post. And he said, well, he said, I better have a go. He said, being an officer, they'll probably take a bit of notice. Well, he'd say, they did say him to him. So then he just stopped quiet then. Then Jerry, they mounted a heavy machine gun at top of that, and all that day they were under there. They must have thought they were all dead. They just carried quiet, and they were using a heavy machine gun on Marines and what have you, till they run away, you know, it went off, you know. It's absolutely murder.
You say you don't feel bitter about it now, but did you at the time?
Well, yes. When I got back to Alice, I wanted lucky wounds. I made it over the mountain eventually. In hospital for over 3 months, and Oh, very bitter. I mean, to me, it was just a plain bloody atrocity.
What happened when the Marines came?
Well, Jerry, I went after Jerry, and the left submarine stopped on the site. Well, I went up with this bungalow at the crossroad. We used it as a... It was officers where they slept normally, and canteen, what the canteen we had. I went up there, and they dressed me wound. And they said, underneath the cellar, they're like a, underneath the bungalow, they're like a big cellar, open to outside in a way, where they used to keep animals in, I believe, Creedens. He said, get in there, like, for the time being. So I went in there, and in there, the load of dead bodies. What were in there, they're all dead. Sergeant Pinch back here were laid like that. What they'd done there, they'd just thrown grenades in, you know, it's that. That's it, like. So I stopped there. I don't know how long, and it was dark. And they shouted down, anybody in here, come out. Ah, blows. I went to in at bungalow, and then a wagon come. They took me and Alf, and Sergeant took, we showed him, we took to a convent on the outskirts of Kinnear. It was a makeshift hospital, like, you know. We stopped there, nuns were still there. And I can't remember any food there. I can't remember eating once the invasion. I must have had some, but I can't remember any eating. There were no bloody food, you know. And we stopped there just quite a few days. And while we were there, about 2 days after they'd landed, that we watched them. They'd just come and bomb bloody Kinnear flat. They spent a few hours just continually flying over it. Wave after wave, just dropping bombs, they flattened the bloody place. And they dropped leaflets before. Said they said they were going to do it. They claimed that, I can't believe this or not, that some of the British or New Zealand had got some Jerry prisoners and handed them over to the Cretans, you know, to look after. Well, they took them behind the wall and slit their bloody throats. The Cretans are like that. Great, you know, I want to be their enemy, but their best friend. And Jerry's found out, and they said that were a reprisal for that. Anyway, this hospital we're in, it was a convent, nuns were still there. We were there quite a few days, and bombing kept getting worse, you know. There's some Germans in, and they started screaming out that, you know, they get bombed in bloody hospital. And they were told it's got a big red cross at the top. You're all right with it. They still want to start, you know. They had to stop it, but they didn't like it.
They had to stop what?
They were told there's a big red cross on the top of the hospital. But they still didn't like it. They didn't trust their own pilots, did they? Anyway, they kept them there, and after, I don't know how long, really. Happened 5 days, 4 or 5 days. Bombing got worse and worse, there was noise all over and that, and then one afternoon we could hear that these German troops, they had a whistle, a low-tone whistle, they contacted each other with, you know, different groups. We could hear them, they weren't far off the blooming hospital. Kinnear must have fallen, I think. And when it got dark, they come in, the blokes come in, and my mate Alf, he lives down here, we've been together, and they come and says, you, and you, to Alf. He said, how about me mate? Oh, he said, we're coming back for him, we've got enough now. Well, he went like, and they did come back for me. And I took in a little two-seater car, about 2 hours later it was. Took some more of us, I ended up in a two-seater car. And it took us, I've tried to find a place since I've been back with a car, but it's somewhere near Suda Bay, you know, on the hills, near by the bay. And it was a school. When we got there, they just dumped us out of this car, so we go in there. Well, I went into this school, which had been used as hospital. And you couldn't bloody move. The corridor was crammed full of wounded. He couldn't get in, so this bloke come, he says, and you walk? I says, oh, aye. Well, he says, get up into me and a few more. There's no room in here, he says. Go up the road and lay up for rest the next day, tomorrow, in the, under olive grove, under olives, and come back tomorrow night. So I went up there. And I keep down, you know, in rough sleep, rough like. And woke up in the morning. There, bloody bombing and that, and stuff it all out. I so found a little, under a bit of a banking. One or two more, got under there. Started there for the rest of the day. And there were bloody stuff dropping and planes. Like a bloody air show for them, you know. Anyway, when it got dusk, I come out under this banking, and there were a lot of Australians. We were going to make our way down to this school, which was a hospital, and I got to these Aussies. What are you doing? They were perfectly fit. Oh, I said, we're forward up the rear guard. Next step at rear guard here. And I remember, they give me, say, well, that, you want some tea? I said, aye, I bloody do. And he, give me some tea in an old tin, you know, baked bean tin or something. Then I went down to the hospital, to this school. And I had to stand in the yard, and then about 9 o'clock, an officer come out. Well, he says, you can either stay here, if you do, you'll be a prisoner in the morning. Or if you think you can march 20 miles tonight and 20 miles the following night, you haven't to march through daytime, you couldn't really. Planes. He said, you can take your own chance and have a go and head south. Well, I had a go, like, I mean, I didn't fancy being took, you know, I seen once what they did. So I had a go, and I don't know how to, I managed to get over Bloody Mountains.
What was it like?
Oh, terrible, it was. I've been out in a bush since, and they were at you all the time over, and could hear them firing at the back, you know, they were following up all the way.
Was this the infantry?
Aussies and New Zealanders and British, the infantry, yeah. You could hear the firing all the time. In the distance, you know. And I got over there. And I get in. I walked all that night. And I kept going a bit through the day. And then the following night. And then I was laid up. I got to where the barrier across the road. Now this major, somebody was stopping everybody. A lot of wagon pulled up there. And he says, no farther till it's dark. And then they come over again. Took cover like, and then I gets out on my own. Then no chaps I really knew, you know.
How is it that you'd been separated from the others?
Well, last person I knew of our mob was Alfie in that, when he moved it in that first hospital convent. That's the last chap of ours I saw. Until I got near the beach. When I let it go down in this winding road like that, there's some bloody wagons burning. And down there I met a lad, another clacky, that Clary Walker, he's in home now. And he had a blooming Australian tunic on. I said, I'm getting glad to see you, Clary. And he wasn't wounded. And so he stuck with me. And he helped me. I don't think I'd have made that last bit but for him. He helped me right through. We get down to Sfarkia. It's a little fishing cove, that's all it is. We get down there about 2:30 in the morning, there were ships, you could see ships, and there were some of these barges taking blokes out. Well, they come before we could get our turn, that's all. They had to be away for 3 o'clock in the morning at Navy to get as far as they could before daylight, you know. So we had to disperse up into hills again. So me and Clary, we found a little place under some rocks, and then they come over then that afternoon. and they bombed it, stuffed it solidly. They knew a lot of troops were there, solidly for about, well, I really don't know, it seemed hours. Then it quietened down, and night time come. We made our way down to the beach again, and then we got off, got on to, me and him got on to the HMS Phoebe.
So, you had, how did you cross to the Phoebe?
On a, looked like an invasion barge thing. They just brought some out of the Middle East on our convoy, actually, the first of that. I think it was them.
What kind of a ship was the Phoebe?
A cruiser. Dido-class cruiser. Then we come to Alex with her. And on the way across, this was marvellous to me. When I went aboard, you know, I went up scrambling nets. Now I remember this bloody AB, a big burly bugger, going up net. He grabbed me, lifted him over the side. He said, follow that white line. There'd been a white line in that deck, you know. I went in, I got me leg dressed. And then we shoved down below decks, all the troops. And just sat in a passageway, you know, the Navy gave us some cocoa and some food. Oh, it was bloody lovely. And when it come to daylight, the pads of the ship was on the bridge, and I think it was to stop troops panicking, you know, when you cram down below and you don't know what's happening. And he gives running comments on what were happening then. He said, we're steering swords and all that. We're all naval ships on that convoy, cruisers, destroyers, and the Glengarry, which were the commando ship. And he said, I think, and he said, on the radar we can see a recce come over. And he said he spotted it. Well, then about an hour later, he says, a formation, so many plus approaching, we're going this way. But they couldn't get out of the way, so he says, 40 miles, 20 miles, you know, ahead of me, over at Tannoy. I can see them now. Then he heard guns start up. And he gave a running commentary of that raid. Took about one or two raids. And HMS Perth, she were off sailing long, you know, on the side of us. And he says, you can hear all this banging. He says, the Perth has disappeared in bomb bursts. Then he says, oh, he says, she's coming out, all guns firing, like that, you know. They'd hit the Perth, actually. But how he stood there, he got a running comedy like a chap on the BBC would. I take my hat off to that bloke.
So did that make a big difference to you, to know what was going on?
It kept you calmer. It's obviously, I mean, you're stuck below, I mean, you're hearing guns firing, and you don't know a damn thing what's happening. I think that's why I did it. I mean, there was a ship, picks them up at Heraklion, and the Orion, and she got it, and I read this. There was 200, it was crammed with troops, and it got hit, and when it got to Alex, there was 260 odd dead, and about 200 odd wounded on that ship. It was packed, it's scuttled with troops, you know.
But nobody was hit on the Phoebe?
No, we didn't get nothing, no. No. Just, I think the only ship we got hit on that corner was the Perth. HMS Perth.
How long did it take to get across to Alexandria?
Well, we left on the Phoebe. We got to right out of the danger zone. And then she slung a paravanes over. We could come up on deck then. Let us up, you know. And she slung her paravanes out and she left the convoy, put on full speed, and I don't know why. Planning to go back again, but I don't know. We left the convoy and built elf leather for Alexandria.